Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, but in for Amy this morning is one former state representative, Jeannie Ives, now with Breakthrough Ideas. You hear her commentaries every morning on our program at 7:30 news break. Yep. Jeannie, great to have you. Thanks for joining us. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about our election day here in Illinois on Tuesday, because I mentioned it a bit yesterday, but we didn't dig into it. And since you were much more involved in those legislative races than I was, your perspective would be important. What you were involved in a lot of state, particularly state house races, with your team and volunteers. So tell us from your perspective what happened on Tuesday.
Well, what happened is we had a whole crop of new candidates who got elected, and they are not going to be Durkin accolades. They're not going to go with Jim Durkin, and they basically did the work to put themselves in the position to win. And then with a little more extra help just from really grassroots conservatives, they won. So, I mean, here's the one thing about these races. Like, you don't want to take away from any of the victory that these candidates created for themselves.
Right.
You know, they did the work. They put together the volunteers. And they went door to door, and they resonated with voters, and their message was clear. I mean, obviously it helps when people come in and help them with the messaging, or help provide resources and direction to them. That definitely helps, especially with these new candidates. But for the most part, the entire Republican establishment was completely rejected. And if they didn't get the message this time around, then they're missing opportunities left and right to win in November.
And to illustrate what you're saying, just a couple of races stuck out to me. One was down in Southern Illinois, Cordy versus Hackler. And it sticks out to me because Hackler is a functionary for the state party, and he lost 2-1.
It's great. It's remarkable. And Joe Hackler should lose his job. And in fact, he should have lost his job the minute that he decided to become a candidate in a primary race where, you know, he actually wasn't even part of that district, hadn't lived there for a while, kind of moved back just to run, and then got essentially well over $200,000 from Jim Durkin and Jim Durkin affiliates and Jim Durkin aligned legislators who played in this primary, when they have some sort of, you know, unwritten rule that we're not going to play in legislative races. And then they go and they actually play in legislative races.
Meaning you don't play in legislative races, but we do.
Oh, it's exactly the case.
Right.
I mean, and you know, Durkin just blew through literally, in my count, I mean, at least $500,000. And he lost.
And again, on the other side, the person who won, Jennifer Cordy, tell us about her.
She's just been part of the community all her entire life. She's raised her family there. She's involved. She's one of these moms who, you know, took on school board issues and whatever else. But she's a very involved member of the community, upstanding citizen, all of that. Somebody that, you know, already has a following. I mean, moms with multiple kids obviously have a natural network.
Yeah.
Easy to win. A great contrast to Katie Stewart compared to, you know, by the way, the
former Dem state rep.
Yes. She's the current incumbent. Democrat state rep.
You're right.
You know, all these Republican legislative leaders, these quote unquote leaders, that they all want to play identity politics when picking their candidates. And then what do? They put up your standard white party apparatus white guy to run against a Democrat woman. Oh, I thought you guys liked the women on women matchup, and then you go against a really great candidate.
Right. I should say, Kate, this is a pickup opportunity for House Republicans in a year.
Yeah, and Katie Stewart.
Particularly in Southern Illinois.
Absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
Which should be washed out of Democrats by now. Or
yeah, no, I mean, so it doesn't matter where you are in the state of Illinois. If you're a Democrat legislator, you could be Sue Scher in Decatur, for example. They're just voting just like they're a Chicago Democrat. Their voting record is really terrible for their district. It doesn't match. So you have enormous pickup opportunities.
The other race that struck me, and we mentioned it a bit on the program yesterday, is David Welter, since he was an incumbent, since he was the House Conference GOP point person. And he had been there for a few terms. He had come up through local government, been a county board member in Grundy. And, the way I described Welter, who I've known since he was a county board member, is he's one of these cautionary tales of somebody who goes to Springfield, gets Springfieldified, and goes from a conservative grassroots guy to, I got a title, I got a lapel pin, I'm a status guy, and now I'm going to start making terrible votes. And it finally caught up to him because of this guy, Jed Davis, that ran against him in a primary.
Yeah, so again, you know, no Jed Davis, then we're still stuck with a David Welter. But Jed Davis is just a terrific guy, took on the masking issue. He actually believes things like being pro-life matters.
Affiliated with Families of Faith Christian Academy in Shanahan.
Yes, and you know, fortunately, David Smith with Illinois Family Action, they ran some mail in there. Actually, Breakthrough Ideas, we're a C4, we ran some mail in there. All about David Welter's policy votes. You know, there's no reason to talk about anything else. Let's talk about policy, because his policy is terrible. One of the last pieces that we did basically has David Welter talking about, I'm for lower taxes. Literally took his Facebook post, put it on a mail piece, and said, no, you're not. You're not for lower taxes, David Welter. You voted to double the gas tax. You voted to double the vehicle fees, everything else. I mean, these people, you cannot believe the politicians' mail, their lies. You have to actually look at their record. And I think that's actually what happened here, because, I mean, talk about the Irvin race for just a moment here. So the DGA played in the race, and otherwise, but for the DGA playing this
Pritzker
race.
Pritzker picked his opponent.
Yeah, Pritzker.
Right.
No. What happened is a bunch of Republicans tried to run a Democrat, and everybody did, me, you, other people, all we did was, this is who Richard Irvin is. We didn't make up those lines. He actually said those lines. He praised Pritzker, praised BLM. He actually stood down to the rioters. I mean, we didn't make him up. We just exposed who he was. And then we get blamed for this. Oh, you're creating chaos. No.
Right. Yeah. No, you were exposing the disconnect between the combine Republican cowards and the actual Republican primary voters in this state who've gotten a lot more sophisticated and a lot more skeptical. It's funny you talk about the mail and what to believe. So I was having this conversation with a Bloomberg reporter yesterday about the governor's race, and we were just going back and forth about how the landscape has changed, but including the voter being more skeptical in a good way, like less easily duped. And my point to him was a point I made on this show before, which is, you know, there's politicians who think they can just make claims and get away with it. And because a lot of them have.
Yep.
And then there's what happens when you make an argument in the face of a claim that's made. So, you know, the claim is that I'm a conservative Republican. And then, well, you say that, and then we have you voting in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries, and we have you being an enthusiastic supporter of BLM, and we have you being an enthusiastic supporter of Sanctuary State, and we have you with, you know, presiding over a city with the highest property taxes in the nation for a mid-size city, and so on and so forth. And then people look at that and say, well, you know, don't believe me, just believe the evidence that I'm presenting in support of an argument. You have to make arguments, not just claims, and there's a difference.
Well, and for too many. I mean, but the Democrats get away with just making claims because we never have enough money or the right candidate to raise that issue.
Well, that right. And also we have candidates who do the same thing.
Absolutely.
They just make claims. Yep. I'm a tax fighter. No, I'm a tax fighter. He's not a tax fighter. I'm a tax fighter. I'm tough on crime. No, I'm not. He's not tough on crime. I'm tough on crime. That's not a discussion. That's not an argument. That's not a debate. Those are just two people making claims and trying to, you know, with aesthetically pleasing ads, convince you one versus the other is the crime fighter, rather than just taking your time because you have it over the course of a campaign to make a case and to make a case consistently so that people get a real multidimensional feel for who you are and what you're planning on doing. I mean, it's just like a 15-degree dial turn, but it makes a big difference.
Well, I think it's funny. So let's go back to you. So a Bloomberg reporter contacts you, wants information from you. Apparently the New York Times came out with some big, you know, diatribe about the Illinois governor's race, which they contacted me three different times to participate in that conversation. And, you know, I'm like, I'm not calling the New York Times back after they.
This was the pre-election piece by Reid Epstein.
Yes. And he called me like three different times. I'm like, I'm not responding to you. You guys, first of all, you have lied about my comments before and taken everything out of context.
Well, we are the New York Times.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's what we do. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, but the Wall Street Journal, I mean, back in 2018, this is like incredible Sunday big. Discussion about Bruce Rauner and how great he is. Mm-hmm. Then yet the same thing, you got Karl Rove writing about how great, you know, Richard Irvin is. And then you've got Richard Irvin showing up on the Laura Ingraham show. I mean,
and Hannity.
Oh gosh. Yeah. It's just, you know, and then Jesse Sullivan shows up on another primetime show too. I can't remember who he was with on Fox News. I'm like, oh my gosh, these people who are looking at it from afar have no idea. And that's what the best thing about Tuesday was, is that people who thought that they knew everything about election politics and who was going to win this race absolutely got their comeuppance.
Well, because they, you know, they think the voters are just sort of incidental to mm-hmm. the process. It's like, you know, we're doing the mail. We got this thing going on. It's like, oh, and, you know, what's the response from the voters? They'll figure out that what we're doing is the proper thing and they'll just go along,
right,
as opposed to sort of reflecting back to voters some acknowledgement of their preeminent concerns and then some argument to address their preeminent concerns. Now, you know, these voters, I mean, the campaign's going great, you know, except for the voters. We could just.
I've checked every box. Yeah.
Yeah. Except that. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Jeannie Ives. I met you at the Freedom Summit back in November, and it's nice to hear your voice this morning. We know the GOP in Illinois is a mess, and my comment is really, when you run for office, like when Trump ran for office, if you simply do what you say or try, my dad used to say, do what you say or try dying. Make arguments. Yeah. Die trying. Make arguments, not claims. excuse me. You'll get a lot farther, and people who are paying attention will reelect you. And I agree that it's frustrating for all of us involved who are paying attention. And I think it's such a good thing that voters, at least in this election, were acting more, they were more sophisticated. They were more on it. My polling place was packed at lunchtime from, you know, that never happens around here in Western Springs. It doesn't. So I was really happy that people were there. Of course, I was, you know, chatting with the people in line and, you know, ran into a friend, and she's a complete liberal. We talked a bit about, she's a teacher also. She and I talked a little bit about poverty, how the abortion issue affects Black women in poverty. And I said, yeah, well, there have been programs and all sorts of things to try to help these women on both sides, the pro-choice and the pro-life. They're still getting pregnant. They're still, you know, we're still funding their abortions and on and on and on.
Yeah.
But you know, Dan, I'm a realist too. I try really hard to, you know, just for self-protection. It's like, you've got to be real and not let so much emotion, Well, I guess emotion just comes into it because we're guttural, people.
I mean, emotion's fine. It just needs to be, twinned with, cognitive considerations. Yeah.
Exactly. I know. I wish people, I think we've got a lot of people out there working harder to understand the issues. God knows I'm trying.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, of course, talking about the governor's race, short general election cycle here. We've got a 4-month sprint. We go from one sprint to the other. The question that everybody wants to know, because the argument has been made by so many over the last several weeks, can Darren Bailey beat J.B. Pritzker? What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Or is it time to just concede defeat, as some seem wanting to do? So I did a general election survey last week and put out a memo that summarizes it yesterday. Or my pollster put it together, Fabrizio Lee, who, again, is Trump's pollster as well. And Tony Fabrizio has been like a fixture in polling inside the Beltway for 30 years at least. I shared some of the numbers that I think are interesting, and they're also contained in this polling memo that I posted on Twitter and Facebook if you want to take a look at it. But it starts with the environment, because the environment is one of the reasons that you've got a winnable race on your hands for governor in Illinois. And the environment obviously starts with the big guy. The big guy won Illinois in 2020 by 17 points, and right now his approval rating is minus 13, 43-56. Biden's approval rating in Illinois is precisely the same as Trump's. So for all those people, oh my gosh, they're going to tie him to Trump and that's going to be it. And you see Governor Spaulding doing that already, doing that on election night, and tie him to Trump. Well, right. Well, by the way, Governor Spaulding has walked in lockstep with the big guy. And the big guy is in the same position in the minds of voters that Trump is. Different cohorts of voters, of course. But in terms of anchors, if you think Trump weighs down Republicans in Illinois, Biden weighs down Democrats. And at about the same weight. Well, actually, exactly the same weight. How about that? Something else, too. And, Jeannie, you'll appreciate this. You understand these things.
I don't know. He's pretty hefty. Are you sure there's not a little bit of a weight differential?
I should be more specific. The same polling weight.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Not actual. Right track, wrong track. Again, general election audience. This is in the Republican primary. It's like, 10 to 90 wrong track. But in the general election, 40 to 59, the general election electorate. Mm-hmm. So right track, 40%, 59, wrong track, minus 19. So that's sort of a proxy, if you do it right, for what people think about the chief executive. If they think the state is on the wrong track, then they think they're more likely than not to think that the guy leading the state is leading us down the wrong track, and we probably need to consider a change. So it shows, I mean, and Bailey's not, you know, up by 19, but it shows that there's upside is the point. Right.
Well, I mean, I also like to just talk about compare Illinois to our surrounding states. I mean, we have gone in the opposite direction. So Iowa, my favorite one, J.B.
Pritzker. Reynolds.
Yep. Yeah, J.B. Pritzker puts in a progressive income tax, puts on the referendum, it fails. But he essentially wanted to make the top rate 8% and do it in a progressive income tax. Iowa does the complete opposite. They move from a progressive income tax to a flat tax, and their flat tax is lower than Illinois'. Opposite direction.
Right.
I mean, same thing on the abortion issue. You know, they put in a heartbeat bill. We put in abortion on demand anytime taxpayer funded.
And stripped parental notification.
And on top of that, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the context is always important because it reminds people that you don't have to live this way.
That's right.
There are people not far from us living in a very different environment. Maybe someday we could have something nice. Just a couple other numbers. So right now, the generic ballot. So are you more likely, if the election were held today, you're more likely to vote for the Republican candidate versus the Democrat candidate? No names. Generic ballot is only +2 for the Dems, which, again, speaks to environment. Because, you know, if you model this based on recent election returns, you know, it's been more like a +11 to +14 spread. So that's a big difference. And, of course, that is redounding to the benefit of Bailey. Now, head-to-head, Pritzker versus Bailey, the ballot test, Pritzker is +7, 50-43. But there's a couple things with that. One is I think most people, particularly those lamenting the Bailey nomination, think, oh, my gosh, this is a 20-point race, and he's got, you know,
right,
he's got
no
like
chance.
Right.
Nobody, I think people are surprised it's in the single digits, that spread.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, so this is going to be a completely different race than the primary for a number of reasons, including that everybody knows who J.B. Pritzker is. Everybody has an opinion of him. And so part of the superior name ID drives a better ballot performance against a lesser known opponent, despite some of those environmental numbers that I described. So he's +7. But here's an interesting thing. Among those surveyed who've heard of both Pritzker and Bailey, Bailey's +3. So
wow.
He's got to increase his name ID. He's got to attach a brand to that name ID that's palatable. So this isn't you just get to sit back now and people will get to know me and they'll get to like me and then I'll win. No, this is a winnable race, but it will be an absolute dogfight. And if Bailey does his campaign right, here's what the next 4 months will look like. Pritzker's up 47-44. Pritzker's up 48-45. Pritzker's up 44-43. I mean, this is going to be pounding, pounding, pounding both directions because, as we know, Spalding has his eye on the White House, so he'll spend $1 billion if that's what it takes to win re-election so he can go back to New Hampshire on November 9th and start working on this 2024 presidential campaign. That's what he wants to do. But it's just different. You're not going to see over a month a 20-point swing like you saw in the primary with candidates that were not particularly well-known and people were getting to know.
You need to make sure that you whisper that because there may actually be people that want J.B. Pritzker to be the Democrat nominee for president. So then they maybe actually make sure that he gets elected here to give him a better chance because,
Who knows? But there's an opportunity to get him out before that. It's November 8th. You don't have to let him run. Win.
Would you just love to see him run for the Democrat nomination for president? Would you just love him to be the nominee?
Well, he can still
run.
Even if he loses this race, he can still turn around and run for president if he wants.
But that's how insane Illinois. I guess I don't want to say just everything here. I mean, the idea that he thinks coming out of Illinois that he thinks with his policies that they're going to sell to a national audience. What's that guy smoking?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess he saw Obama do it and he figures he can do it again. You know, we scale the Illinois model to D.C., you know, not so long ago.
We did with Lincoln, and that was a good one.
Well, right.
You know,
it can go a couple. Yeah, we can send, positive leadership to D.C. or do what we've normally done for the last 170 years, which is send. Yeah, not positive. Neil and Lyons, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Jeannie. Good morning. What an interesting primary. I did some rough numbers, and if you look at all the votes cast on the Republican side, I think those numbers were really close to what Pritzker got, vote totals wise. So I did quick math, and then my next question is that if Bailey does get in, and I mean you guys have a better pulse on the General Assembly than I do, will they have a supermajority this time? Because that was Rauner's big problem, that since Madigan was in there, he was able to hamstring everything.
Yeah, Rauner's problem was Rauner.
I don't want to go back there. That's probably true.
Yeah, but what's the General Assembly going to look like?
Yeah, but so here's the deal.
Yeah. Is it going to be a veto-proof General Assembly, do you think? Or,
I don't think so.
We'll let Jeannie address that. Thanks
so first of all, Rauner did not have super majorities. He had the legislature was in the minority, but he did have, it was not a veto proof. So he could veto legislation and it could be sustained. So that's one thing. And definitely we need to take away their super majorities. That'll be important. But the governorship in the state of Illinois is actually very powerful. You run a lot of the different agencies. And I know we're going to talk with Christy Noem here later, but I was discussing South Dakota politics with my sister. And actually, the Republican delegates are the ones who actually pick the constitutional offices. So everything but governor is picked by Republican insiders, whatever you want to call them. It's not even on the ballot. That's not the case here. You've got constitutional offices that are broadly elected. You've got you get to run your entire agencies. And when I say South Dakota has constitutional offices, I'm talking about the director of public education is a constitutional office. Their public utilities is a constitutional office that insiders pick from a delegate standpoint. Here, the governor gets to decide all of that. He's got a lot of power and he's got a bully pulpit. And there's a reason for hope here because I know some of the challengers running against some of these Democrats, and I see real opportunity.
Well, and so the real opportunity for the House, at minimum, to get out of the super minority and be in a position, even if Republicans are still in the minority, which is more likely than not, you would have, if Bailey were successful, you would have more to work with, and you could put together coalitions that could actually move the flag on some issues, at least.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And you don't have Mike Madigan,
Right. Chris Welch is no Mike Madigan, and Don Harmon is no John Cullerton. And so, right, they don't have the same discipline. They don't generate the same loyalty. No, that's a good point, too. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Jeannie. Dan, I called yesterday, and I wanted to mention Jeannie because – Jeannie, I believe the reason for the amount of Bailey's win yesterday or Tuesday was a lot of us vicariously voting for you through him after you got jobbed by the scarecrow from the Wizard of Oz 4 years ago and the horrible lies he made up about you. And I was wondering if you guys, I do believe there was a real energy against the establishment, and I wonder if you think that's going to carry through to a general election, because I think it was more anger at Republicans as opposed to Fathead Pritzker. So I wanted to see what you thought about that.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Well, I'll let Jeannie answer, but I would just add this. The anger among Republicans, as expressed on Tuesday, it's very real against Governor Spaulding. I mean, his numbers in the Republican primary among Republican primary voters are 5 to 95 disapprove, and the intensity is off the scale, just like he is. So no, you have a motivated movement, I would say, afoot, and now can you fold in some people that are, you know, not as partisan, not perhaps as ideological? And the good news is, just one other number from that survey, among independents right now, self-described independents in this survey, Bailey is plus 19. So can he pull centrist voters in? Well, yes, because you know where centrist voters are leaning, and this is nationally. They're leaning Republican. So that's another environmental contextual factor that's really important, and it right now serves the interests of Republican candidates. One other thing, though, from Neil and Lyons, you know, talking about what the General Assembly look like, composition will be, what it will look like if Bailey were elected in November, and so what could happen. I think the other thing that's going to happen is you may have different leadership on the Republican side, in the Republican caucuses, in both the House and the Senate than you do currently. There may be a reckoning coming at the leadership level internally, just as we saw a reckoning coming at the ballot box on Tuesday.
Well, that's always been the problem.
It has been. John in Lincolnwood.
Oh, Dan and Jeannie, it's so good to hear your voice. I wanted to just say that, you know, I was so happy the other night that Bailey won decisively. But what scared me is that I saw how many votes Pritzker got, and I was wondering, you know, I know you're saying that it's close in margins and stuff, and my point is, I'm trying to get behind Bailey 100%. I'm trying to push him towards everybody I know. I just want to wear T-shirts at the gym. I want his name everywhere.
Yeah.
And where can we get that? I mean, if you don't get it out, people just like, oh, he's just some farmer and blah blah. It's amazing how what people think, and I'm like, no, you really haven't listened to him. You're listening to the propaganda. So thanks, Dan. I just want to know.
Thanks for the call, John. Well, BaileyForIllinois.com, his website, is a good place to start. Yeah, you're right. And he's got to ramp it up quick because, of course, Spalding is already on the attack with commercials on the air as of yesterday, which, of course, was anticipated.
Well, I know Darren Bailey. He's already taken up he's got a second place up here, so he can be in the suburbs and in Chicagoland, and he's already working it. So I'm not worried about Darren Bailey's work. He put in the work. He proved up that he was willing to go anywhere, talk to anybody. And so from that standpoint, I encourage you to contact the campaign. Why don't you just be your own little network of information to voters that you might know? And if everybody does that, he can win. He can pull people over. Listen, having conversations with other folks actually does inform them and makes a difference in how they vote. 100%. And so everybody's got to be their own little campaign team for Darren Bailey in their own way.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Thank you. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We talked about this, but in front of me this morning, I should mention, former state representative and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives, now at Breakthrough Ideas.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So we talked about this, Amy and I did, with John Nolte, Breitbart News, yesterday a bit. This explosive bombshell testimony from Cassidy Hutchison before the January 6th Star Chamber, accusing Trump of, based on somebody telling her, being demanding to be taken to the Capitol on Jan 6 during the rioting, lunging at a Secret Service agent, attempting to commandeer the vehicle. I mean, you know, something out of a bad, you know, buddy cop movie. Channeling his inner Dirty Harry was Trump on that day.
How many Russian agents were involved in putting together this dossier?
Well, right, and putting it together.
Kind of like, you know, the prostitutes in Russia.
Putting together Cassidy Hutchison's testimony?
Yes.
How many Russian agents were involved? Yeah, it was a steal prepared.
Yes.
So here's the thing about it. We find out that the Jan 6 Star Chamber did not contact Secret Service before Hutchison's testimony. Hutchison is former aide to White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Did not contact Chief of Staff. Hutchison said that Tony Ornato, who's a former Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, told her about the incident involving Trump. He told her that Trump repeatedly demanded that Secret Service take him to the Capitol, that Trump lunged at a Secret Service agent, tried to grab the wheel of a presidential SUV when agents would not allow that. However, in addition to this being hearsay evidence, in addition to the being a Star Chamber, now you have put the Secret Service in the uncomfortable position of having to be public on something like this, which they don't want to be for any president. And a former Secret Service agent has an interesting op-ed in Newsweek. We'll get to it in a moment. A source close to Ornato told Fox News that Ornato, Ms. Hutchison's source for this story, watched the hearing yesterday, was shocked when Hutchison made the allegation about the steering wheel. Fox News reporting that both Bobby Engel, the top agent on Trump's Secret Service detail who was in the car, and Ornato, the source cited by Hutchison as the basis of her testimony, but who was not in the car, testified in the Jan 6 committee in private over the past year. Fox News previously reporting that a source close to the Secret Service says both men, the agent in the car as well as her source for the story, so she says, are willing to testify under oath that Hutchison's story about Trump is not true. I mean, does it ever end with these people?
But it worked in the Vidman case, right? So
yes.
Hearsay evidence there. Yeah. Leads to a charge of abuse of a power. So why not try this all again?
I wasn't on the call, but I know somebody who was.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
I wasn't in the car, but I heard from somebody who's in the car, and then the somebody in the car says not true.
No, I heard it's two people removed. Right? I heard from somebody who knows somebody in the car.
Oh, that's right.
You know, this is sort of why hearsay evidence with, and I won't go into all the exceptions and bore you, but with some exceptions is not allowed in criminal trials. And I understand, Dan, this isn't a criminal trial. It's a committee hearing. It's
an
investigation. I know. Right. Oh, well, when
that's what you want to lead to.
Well, when they
criminal charge so that he can't run in 2024, they're afraid of him.
Well, when they can figure it out, sometimes they are prepared to make a criminal referral to the DOJ, and sometimes they're not. Benny Thompson, the Star Chamber chairman, said he was open to that initially. Then more recently he said, no, that's beyond our pay grade. But then Liz Cheney said, that's an unanswered question. That's a maybe right now. So even the members of the Star Chamber can't get their disposition straight in terms of what they're attempting to do here. But what you see here, and which is why due process norms should be reflected in the work of congressional committees, for example, is you have everyone on that Star Chamber who has the same position regarding Trump, who's trying to get to the same place, who's ignoring any evidence or testimony that would inhibit them from getting to the place they want to with Trump, from getting to the conclusion that they have already sketched out on what happened on January 6th.
So when you poll this, can you poll whether or not anybody cares what the hell's going on with the J6 committee? Because honestly, I'm pretty informed about politics. I haven't watched one bit of this at all. I don't care. I don't care what they're doing. Doesn't matter in my life. Honestly, don't care.
You know, I'm sort of in the same camp. I mean, I paid a little bit more attention to it, but we haven't talked a lot about it for that reason, because it's illegitimate. So I was talking to a friend, you've heard him on these airwaves, Jerry Agar, who's a radio talk show host in Toronto. I said, why would I lend legitimacy to a process that's illegitimate any more than I would lend legitimacy to a criminal trial where the defendant was not allowed to present his case? Because that's what you have here. Analogize it. You have the accused not being able to call witnesses, not being represented in the process in terms of being able to have representatives question those witnesses being brought by the prosecution. It's an analogy, but I think it's an apt one, particularly when you're talking about something as serious as what happened on January 6th, and you're talking about your legislative branch and your executive branch of your government.
But this may be a turning point in people's attention on this entire sham committee, because when you have something so explosive as Cassidy's statements, and then you have the same thing happening with the Secret Service basically coming saying she's lying. Nobody wants to use that word, but she's lying. She's lying. Okay. She wasn't there. She's lying. And now it's going to actually, there'll probably be blowback now. Now maybe people pay attention because it's all false.
Well, yeah.
I think that things like this actually can elevate and inform people's opinion about what's going on in D.C. with these folks.
It could actually boomerang.
Yeah, it could boomerang on them now, which is a good thing. I think now people may say, well, what the hell? We're going through another Steele dossier moment?
Well,
and by the way, honestly, how does Cassidy get even a job in the administration if she's this type of person? I'm mystified by some of the hires that they had.
Well, yeah, I mean, the personnel decisions, was not a strength of Trump's, generally speaking. When it came to nominees for Supreme Court, yes, with help from people like Leonard Leo at the Federalist Society. When it came to some of the people around him and around senior officials, less so, clearly. The interesting piece I mentioned, Evie Pomporos, she's a former Secret Service special agent. She writes this in Newsweek about Cassidy Hutchins' testimony. She, before judging the credibility of Hutchinson's testimony, we must first allow time for anyone who actually witnessed the event firsthand to counter, clarify, or corroborate. Regardless, the claim itself shines a light on something remarkable. By the way, former Secret Service agent, allow time for anyone who actually witnessed the event firsthand to counter, clarify, or corroborate. Well, the Star Chamber's not interested in that. Sorry.
Nope.
Yeah. If these allegations hold true, the Secret Service has once again lived up to its ideals. As has always been my experience, the Secret Service did not and does not air the dirty laundry of its protectees, presence, or otherwise. And she mentions the Secret Service's unwillingness to participate in the impeachment of President Clinton when they were inquired as to what they knew about his relationship with Monica Lewinsky. She writes, the service pushed back, saying that doing so would jeopardize their overall mission. The Secret Service works very hard to build rapport with their designated protectees, especially the President of the United States. It's a relationship built on mutual trust and respect. Without it, your mission is compromised. Well, hey, if we have to compromise the relationship between the Secret Service and the president in order to get at Trump, then, hey, that's what we'll do. It's just politics.
So what's interesting here is they didn't even ask the Secret Service ahead of Cassidy's testimony, which they could have gotten the same response that the service has given in previous situations like you just described.
And
they didn't do that because maybe they knew the Secret Service would say no.
And when is Bobby Engel and Tony Ornato, when are they scheduled to testify? Again, the reporting, not just from Fox, is that both men are prepared to testify under oath that Hutchinson's story about Trump is not true. So when are they scheduled to testify? Anybody know? Yeah, I don't think so. David in Winnetka, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hey, good morning, guys. You know, we all know the committee thing is insane. This Hutchinson thing is nuts, and it's all whatever. But what it does do is it opens up the floodgates for the Dems to start picking off Republicans that would nullify them from partaking in the voting coming up in the primaries. And I just wanted to see what your thought process was on that.
Well, thanks for the call, David. You had a response to that?
No.
Okay. Sarah, Glenview.
Yeah, hi. This is an ouch moment. How much is the Congress wasting our taxpayer dollars on this Hollywood production? We're paying $6 a gallon for gas, budgeting our groceries, and we're watching our money, that we hard-earned money, being just flushed down the you-know-what.
Thanks for the call, Sarah. And this is why Liz Cheney has to appeal to Democrats to try to salvage herself in a Republican primary in Wyoming, where she is completely underwater. But I hate to see her go along with Adam Kinzinger. Those would be
sad.
Be a second great loss to this august body. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yeah, good morning. You know, they're not going to be concerned about truth or change any of their tactics until they get clobbered in states that they normally, you know, win, like Washington State or Illinois. They're not going to change anything. But like in 1980, they need to get clobbered to actually have any sort of shame and change anything. But on another note here, this whole story is so ridiculous. I remember when Obama was coming in to vote in 2012, I was driving home on 294, drove right by O'Hare, and they were making a big deal about Obama coming home to vote. And sure enough, there's three military helicopters crossing 294, because I'm like, that's got to be Obama, because they take three of these helicopters with the president for security reasons. And when does the president, I mean, so they're going to have multiple limos, multiple SUVs, and whenever is the president going to be in the front seat to be able to lunge at the wheel? It's nuts. The president is protected in the back. Makes absolutely no sense. Smell test completely fails it, just on if you know anything about the way the security is surrounding the president. Asinine. That's the way these people are.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Well, now for somebody who believes whatever the Jan 6 committee feeds him, Never Trumper Tom from Deer Park.
Well, hey, Dan, thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Keep your hands on that dump button, as you usually do, because you and your audience don't want to hear what I have to say.
Well, that's why I took your call. That's why I took your call, bedwetter. So just say what you have to say.
So it's a two-hour hearing, of which we can't discuss what happened for the other 1 hour and 59 minutes, because it's a short segment. But you, as usual, take the propaganda route and take something that very well could be discredited, but let's have the Secret Service agents come in. And in the meantime, let's talk about what she said about Donald Trump telling the armed people to let him in because they're not going to hurt me. They're not here to hurt me. And hang Mike Pence. We'll let him get hung. Do you ever want to tell your audience anything they should know instead of the BS that they want to hear?
Are you done now? Because I don't want to be accused of dumping you.
No, Dan, I could go till 9 o'clock if you'd let me, sir.
Well, obviously,
whatever you want to talk.
Obviously,
about.
That's not going to happen. You're not that interesting. Thanks for the call, Tom. Well, see, the thing that Tom doesn't appreciate, I mean, it's not a singular thing, but one of the things is, it's funny. He says, "Let them testify," and it could very well be that her story is incredible. Well, you know, I don't know, Tom from Deer Park, if you've ever had the occasion to, you know, watch a Matlock episode or Law and Order, you know, because you don't strike me as particularly educated on the norms of a free society institution, due process, the legal system. So I think maybe a TV show would at least inform you of this basic tenet. If the witness is not credible,
right?
If the witness is lying about one thing,
right,
then all of her testimony
is not credible,
right? You think prosecutors, much less, or even Congress beings, You think they would want to concede that she perjured herself before a House committee? I know she was lying about this, but believe her about all this other stuff. Those are the kind of witnesses you're relying on for your, you know, continued jihad against President Trump and what you would call the January 6th insurrectionists.
Tom probably has C-SPAN on, you know, continuous, what am I going to say, save mode, right? Yeah, he's always watching it.
Yeah,
who has 2 hours to watch C-SPAN?
I think
he
has Morning Joe on a continuous loop. I think it's just like Mika and Joe over and over again, and it's rotted his his gray matter. But, I mean, it's just such a talk about the other 2 hours of her testimony. If what she's saying here, which was the bombshell reported by all those Never Trump news outlets that Tom is cheering on, that's what they want us to focus on. And if that is untrue, or your star chamber, Tom, from Deer Park and you Never Trumpers, won't call the Secret Service agent or the source that Hutchinson provided for her story, then what does that say about the star chamber, and what does it say about Hutchinson's testimony? And what does it say about you? Tom and Oswego.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Jeannie. I think what infuriates me more than the actual star chamber, which I don't even pay attention, again, is the news media. If you watch some of the clips from MSNBC, CNN, these news organizations, they literally call Trump a terrorist for trying to lunge at the steering wheel. They are just off the charts crazy. And this is what people like Tom, and I apologize for all the other Toms out there.
Right.
That's what they hear and that's what they see. It's just, it's beyond me. I can't even have conversations with quite a few of my friends that think this stuff is real. And it's really disappointing. There's no common sense anymore in these conversations. It's disappointing. But the media is the one that really should be held accountable for this, because they throw this stuff out there, but there's never a correction.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate it.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former state legislator and gubernatorial candidate, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas. She's Jeannie Ives. Jeannie, you know a little something about one congressman, Sean Casten.
More than I care to.
Yeah. So Sean Casten won his primary, the socialist primary between him and Marie Newman. This is the 6th Congressional, the new 6th Congressional, which is a real pickup opportunity for Republicans, particularly in this year.
Absolutely.
And before we get to the Republican victor and nominee, Keith Peacow, the mayor of Orland Park, just a reminder about who Sean Casten is. Here's a little message to you gun owners from Sean Casten.
Unless you're a member of a well-regulated militia, tell me why you need to own a gun, right? Having small genitals is not a sufficient reason to own a gun.
Having small genitals is not a sufficient reason to have a gun.
Well, I'm sure he knows all about that, the small genitals part. Yeah. Apparently he's in competition with Lori Lightfoot for who's got the biggest dong in town, the region, maybe. Yeah, so that's Sean Casten.
They're both vulgar individuals. I mean, the stuff that Sean Casten tweeted out, misogynist, actually sexist. You know, he's a disgusting individual.
Well, that statement right there is misogynistic. Women don't own guns?
Yeah.
Are they compensating? Do they have penis envy, Sean Casten, female gun owners? Is that what you're saying? The fun part about Sean Casten is his alter ego, MC P-Hat. He's an amateur rapper, don't you know? It started on the House floor and then came home to Downers Grove. Here's Sean Casten talking climate change and making an appeal to authority, noted climatologist Fergie from Black Eyed Peas.
The most important federal agencies to fight climate change. I rise to continue our celebration of hot FERC summer. As climate activist Fergie would certainly say, the FERCalicious definition is to make our planet cooler. So listen up, y'all, because this is it. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, better known as the F to the E to the R to the C, is one of the most important federal agencies to fight climate change, and if I'm doing this right, one that a few more of you are now keeping track of. Having a well-air-conditioned home when it's hot, that's FERCalicious. Getting your electricity from the lowest-cost reliable source, FERCalicious. An electric transmission system that keeps everything from electric vehicles to steel mills running with zero-carbon electricity, FERCalicious. With record-setting heat waves already causing deadly droughts, wildfires, and overwhelmed power grids, we've run out the clock and must transition to a clean energy economy, and we need FERC's help. So today I'm proud to introduce the Right to Timely Rehearings at FERC Act with my friend Mr. Malinowski, a bill to ensure that everyone has access to fair and timely hearings at the commission. But Congress can't do this alone. Moving at the pace demanded by the climate crisis will take all hands on deck, and a fully staffed FERC is going to be critical to that success. Thank you, Madam Speaker, and I yield back so I can...
What a joke. I mean, the guy, so many lies in there. Hot FERC summer, Fergie. I mean, the guy's, he's so bizarre.
It's
but you know how the Daily Herald characterizes him?
Comical.
Yeah. The Daily Herald calls him a moderate. He's... He's got a worse, a more progressive record than AOC. Even AOC votes against crony corporate tax credits. He's a joke.
Well, look, this is all in preparation for his next career as a rap star.
Oh,
you got a little taste of it on the House floor, but let me turn the mic over to.
I have PTSD. I think.
Let me turn the mic over to MCP Hat for a little bit more before we get to PCO.
There's so many problems in the world today, and so many politicians are unwilling to say anything that might alienate their base. But what do you do when that base is racist and science denying and loony? Yeah, I said it so soon because a base that ain't nothing but a lazy excuse made by a man who knows that his views got frozen in time about 1962. But we know that the future belongs to the proud, to the loud, the unbowed, those endowed with the knowledge, the true leaders. And I follow the crowd. And they complain we don't respect their power, but they got no respect for those who didn't come on the Mayflower. And I heard the arc of history bends towards justice, but I got no time for those who say, trust us, I'll take care of all of you later. Soon as I'm done with this fundraiser, paid for by men who don't like our laws, paid for by men who don't like our cause, paid for by men who, despite all their flaws, they got way more access to government. Because when it comes down to justice, it's might that makes right. Sticks and stones that break bones don't bring words to this fight. But let's face up to some unpleasant, self-evident truths. In this town, you got no power if you got nothing to lose. But as far as I know, it's still our right to choose which of these junk politicians about to learn how to lose. And...
So I didn't know that.
By the way, the screeching you heard was from Hinsdale Men. That was actually men from Hinsdale in attendance to that rap session.
Yeah, he picks up a little bit of a twang too. You know,
he's so street,
like Clinton.
He's
like
so
Hillary.
Street.
Yeah,
so street.
He's so cool. He's so cool. That's exactly what I want representing me.
For more on this, now we're joined by Keith Peacow. He's the Republican nominee for Illinois 6 to face MCP Hat there. Keith Peacow, P-E-K-A-U. KeithPeacow.com is the website. Keith, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Jeannie, for having me.
So are you FERCalicious?
I don't even know how to respond to that speech on the floor. I mean, this is supposed to be a serious job, and you say that on the House floor? That's absurd.
Well, and you're going to hear, I mean, he fancies himself a man of science, and he spends a lot of time, as Jeannie well knows, prattling on about end days. And, that rap isn't really selling well right now with $6 a gallon gas and people's energy, home energy bills going through the roof, too. So it seems to me that's going to be a central issue in your campaign.
I think it's going to be the main issue in the campaign is inflation and $6 a gallon gas. It feeds everything. It feeds grocery prices. It feeds everything that you get delivered to anything. And that's what people care about.
and they want to be able to live their lives and not have to make a choice between buying gas and putting and buying groceries. And that's where they're at right now. And Sean Casten's policies, I mean, he's proven it over time. He wants to see higher gas prices. He wants to see, he doesn't want to see anything with gas and oil. And that's just not, it's not realistic. It's not realistic for probably centuries. And the American public deserve better.
Yeah, this is the only thing that he wants to focus on. And so I think you have a great opportunity here to actually inform folks, and not only just on this issue, but really, really this issue, because a lot of folks, and we're going to talk about it later, I know, in the show, are waking up to the energy scam that has been perpetrated on them by people like Sean Casten. And so I look forward to the conversation, because I think if anything, especially when you look at what's happening in Europe with energy, that this is a huge issue. And I think that Sean Casten is on the wrong side of this, and not just this issue, but all of them. And he's just, boy, I can't wait to watch you win against him in November. It's going to be glorious.
We should be doing everything when it comes to energy, so that we're the world's leading energy producer. We should be doing oil. We should be doing gas. We should be doing nuclear, which we haven't built. We've added the two plants since the 70s. So we should be doing that. We should be doing clean coal. When you have hundreds of years of coal reserves for the whole world, you should be burning it. We burn it more cleanly than anywhere else in the world. We should be doing natural gas, again, over centuries worth of worldwide supply that we know about. If we're doing all of that, that stretches our energy resources for centuries. And in the meantime, developing those other technologies. Solar certainly has a place, especially with our very poor grid in certain parts of the country, of taking things off the grid during peak capacity. So it has a place. Other power sources, if you talk to car dealers, they'll tell you that the future in cars, not electric vehicles, it's hydrogen vehicles.
Yeah.
And once that technology is affordable, it'll still take 40 to 50 years to change over the infrastructure. So this isn't happening in any of our lifetimes. And we need to be cognizant of that, do it all so that we can bring energy, we can bring manufacturing back because of our reliable grid and less expensive energy, manufacturing back from China. We can make sure that Europe is provided liquefied natural gas so they're not dependent on Russia.
So,
helps us against our biggest enemies as well. It brings things back to America. It puts America first. It brings American jobs, manufacturing jobs, back to America for the middle class.
So how's your win being received so far? And what did you find out about how people felt about Casten in the primary? Because actually this district is quite different from the district I ran against Casten in 2 years ago. Maybe 25% of the district is the same, and the rest has really shifted really over to your center of gravity there in the south suburbs, Cook County suburbs. So what are you hearing from folks? What are they concerned about?
Well, the two issues that we heard over and over again, it was inflation, i.e. gas prices and grocery prices, and crime. Those were the two big issues. And you couldn't get two people that are more polar opposite in their views, myself and Sean Casten. Sean Casten's not very well liked up in the current 6th district, so up in DuPage, the people that I was talking to. And then down in the Cook County portion, where I live, I know the people here, and those that are Democrats, they're moderate Democrats. They are not someone that's going to embrace the socialist policies of Sean Casten. He, as you pointed out, he's further left than the squad. He hides it better.
Oh, yeah. Daily Herald called him a moderate. Yeah, Daily Herald called him a moderate. He was the moderate option.
So, and Casten also, being a man of science, as he claims, he's gone, I suspect he'll make an issue of how you managed COVID in Orland Park as the mayor, you and your village board, because, of course, he was 100% on board for the Fauci program of lockdowns and mandates, where you took a lighter touch approach in Orland Park and I think gained some profile for this race for Congress by those briefings you did at public meetings, PowerPoints and details and the bases for your decisions. But how do you how do you size up the importance of the management of COVID as an issue in this campaign?
Well, I think obviously facts matter. And, Sean Casten wants to control your life. I want to give you the freedom. The Constitution matters to me. And the Constitution, when you're in a position of power and you're a mayor, for example, if you look at it, it moderates you. Because before you take anyone's rights away, you have to be really sure about what you're doing. And our approach, people can attack me for my approach all they want. The details are in the numbers. We had a lower case rate than Cook County or the state of Illinois, and we left things open. Our approach worked, and it kept our businesses alive. It gave people choices. And at the end of the day, everyone had a choice of what they wanted to do. Every business had a choice of what they wanted to do. And the town did well financially. People did well financially. People did well mentally. We had just a much better approach. And I would have never guessed this 2 years ago when this started, because the information was, as you know, not complete and limited. I would have never guessed that every decision we made turned out to be correct. But as it turned out, looking back in hindsight, every choice that we made, because we used it based on data and facts, turns out in hindsight to be correct. And now you're hearing you hear the state saying they're going to track the things that we asked them to track. Now that's what they're tracking 2 years later, even though they had this information 2 years ago, weren't giving it to us.
Right.
We hear that masks don't work. We hear that lockdowns don't work. Well, these are all things that we said. We said, hey, if you're going to wear a mask, wear N95s, because those are the ones that actually do something. Okay? Now that's what we're hearing. So we were right all along. And the best thing about it is we did it the way it's supposed to be done with our legislative body. I did not dictate this. We debated it in public, and we voted on it, on every single thing that we did. Imagine that. That that's how we do things in either the state or the federal government. And we did not. We did it by executive order.
Because you're such a reasonable guy and you make arguments that will generate even more hysterics than normal from MCP hat, as you heard, I suspect. And so it's going to be Keith Peacow is a Trump-loving insurrectionist who happens to also be a misogynist, a racist, and a homophobe, and a xenophobe, too. All the phobes. All the isms or ists are going to be thrown your way. How are you going to deal with that?
Listen, I served my country, and I fought for people's rights, for the rights for them to do things I disagree with, because that's what America is about. And you can take any position I've ever taken. You can try and call me extreme. I am my own person. I don't follow anybody else's. I don't follow Trump or anybody else. I use facts to make my decisions, and I base the decisions I make in government. I look at the Constitution, because the Constitution gives us the guide and the principles that we should be following when we're in government.
He is Keith Peacow. He's the Republican nominee for Congress in the 6th, facing Sean Casten. Pickup opportunity for Republicans this year. The website for more information on his campaign, get involved, support Keith, Keith Peacow, P-E-K-A-U, KeithPeacow.com. Keith, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Jeannie and Dan. I appreciate it.
And he joins us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former state legislator and gubernatorial candidate, now principal at Breakthrough Ideas, Jeannie Ives, and we're going to talk to South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem in just a few minutes, but as sort of a lead-in to part of that discussion, this story actually reported by NBC News, rather interesting. Hayden Lay, 17 years old, trekked from South Carolina to Illinois on Tuesday to campaign for Chris Butler, you've heard on the show, Democrat running for Congress, Chris Butler, Black pro-life Democrat who ran in the primary to replace Bobby Rush. Unfortunately, he didn't win in that 25-way primary. Jonathan Jackson did, so we're going to have another Jackson in Congress. Isn't that swell?
Jeez.
But anyway, Hayden Lay from South Carolina traveled to campaign for Chris Butler, pro-life Democrat. Lay, who uses gender-neutral pronouns and isn't old enough to vote, spent the day helping residents learn where Butler stands on a number of issues. And, of course, the way that NBC and the press corps reports this, quoting them, Butler opposes abortion rights. He's pro-life. Lay does, too. She's pro-life. Unlike most Democrats and LGBTQ people, Lay welcomed the Supreme Court's decision Friday to dismantle a half century of precedent by overturning Roe v. Wade. I love the report. I love that part of the reporting. But at least they're profiling Hayden Lay because it's interesting. Lay is among a small but vocal minority of lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer Americans who oppose abortion rights, seeing it as an extension of human rights advocacy. Many of them also appear to take Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion. And the arguments being made, they're going to come after me next with a grain of salt. She said, Hayden Lay, all human life is valuable from the moment that human life begins until natural death. So this is what's interesting. So I believe in free universal health care. Nothing's free, Hayden. Okay. Protecting the environment, gun reform. Friday's decision was just one step in this fight to protect life. It's interesting because, you know, part of this discussion is always once you get beyond the hysterics and start asking questions, just like reasonable questions to reasonable people, not religious cultists for whom abortion is a sacrament. Like, you're pro-life, pro-choice. Oh, I'm pro-choice. Oh, okay. Okay. Any restrictions? Well, like, what do you mean? Well, like sex selection abortions. If a woman wants to abort a child because the child is a girl and she wanted a boy, are you okay with that? No, I don't. You know, it's uncomfortable with that. Mm-hmm. What if a scientist discovered a gay gene? What if, hypothetical? And so you could identify the sexual orientation of your child. And a woman did this test, this, you know, natal screening and found out that her child was likely to be gay or more likely to be gay than straight. And that she wanted to abort the child because the child was more likely to be gay than straight. And this hypothetical, if this, you know, gay gene or proclivity had been identified, you support that? No, I wouldn't support that. Right. Once you attach context to these decisions, it gets a lot more difficult for reasonable people to hew to the orthodoxy of the unreasonable pro-abort extremists. And so that's why I thought this story was just so interesting, because this young woman, yeah, she's a bit all over the place, as a lot of young people are. But I thought her perspective on, like, what I want to do is preserve life. And so, you know, guns are bad because people use guns to kill other people. So I want gun reform, but I also want to protect unborn life. And I want to protect life from, as she said, conception to natural death, which is essentially the pro-life position, which is really interesting.
Well, it's just about any topic. Once you get past the headline and some Democrat staffers' talking points, and you actually talk to real people about the issue, they're much more reasonable than everything, which is why the entire pushback that I've been presenting to when the media has called me about what, you know, now we've got this far right wing, you know, governor candidate. Well, what do you mean? What do you mean far right wing? And by the way, I had this conversation with Greg Hines the other day. He called me,
mm-hmm.
You know, one of your favorites, right?
Oh, yeah.
The only reason I give him deference is he was the first to call out Rauner's lies against me. So I always, you know,
no, I mean, I actually,
that's great.
I actually, we spar all the time, but Greg Hines from Cranes, he's been at Cranes forever. I mean, I like him fine. We just disagree on a bunch of stuff. I like him fine. Sometimes he gets a little silly. I'm sure sometimes he says that about me too, but.
But it's like all these issues. So I have this conversation, like, what do you mean far right wing? What are you talking about? Honestly, the positions that Bailey holds and a number of other Republicans, by the way, are actually reasonable, common sense positions when you actually talk about the issues in details. It's your side, honest. It's the far left, really, that has and that's the same thing with abortion. They think this is going to be their holy grail. Pritzker plans on running on this and winning in November on it. first of all, it doesn't, it's not really something that most people are even concerned about. Well, I mean, there's people pro-life and pro-abort, that this is their issue. I get that. I understand that.
Right.
But the rest of the voting people, this is along their list of things that they're concerned about that are going to inform
their vote. But it's not, right, but it's not the the primary issue that's animating their votes.
That's right. And so that's why you get Youngkin proposing a 15-week abortion ban.
Right.
You get all these other people doing...
Which, by the way, was the Mississippi law. So it was that bar in
Dobbs. No, Mississippi is a backwater, and I have to remind people like that. It was a 15-week abortion ban, the same thing that they have in France.
Right.
And this is unreasonable? No, it's actually very reasonable, which is...
And that's where the majority of the country is.
Absolutely.
And just where, just like a supermajority of Illinoisans support parental notification, which was rescinded by Governor Pritzker and the pro-abort socialists in this state. So, yeah, the issue is a little bit more complicated when you start to provide the necessary nuance to an informed discussion and the contextual factors like, you're really comfortable with people just aborting because they don't want a girl. You're really comfortable with people aborting in a scenario where potentially science would identify a proclivity and a person could have a proclivity to be gay, and you're okay with a mom aborting the child because she doesn't want a gay child. Of course, people are going to recoil at that. But I mean, this is where you start to attach consequences to the positions you say you have, and people move around a little bit, right? All right, coming up, we're going to talk to South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. She's got a new book out. We'll also get whatever she's willing to say about her national ambitions come 2024. That's coming up right after this.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is a daughter of South Dakota.
Yes.
Former state legislator, gubernatorial candidate.
Me and M.K. Pritzker.
She is Jeannie Ives. That's right. I forgot about that.
M.K. Pritzker grew up in South Dakota, too.
Well, to preface a question I want to ask of Governor Kristi Noem, this is going to sound curious, but just listen. I want to play a clip from the front girl for the Socialist Spice Girls. That would be AOC. She was on Colbert the other day, and Colbert asked her about her ambitions.
I know somebody who's going to turn 35 about a month before the election in 2024, and they represent New York's 14th. Is that job appealing to you at all?
I think that...
Theoretically.
Listen, I think that we need to focus on keeping a democracy for anybody to be president in the next couple of years, and that's my central focus, is helping the people of this country. Right
so it's possible. So it's possible.
I don't know about all.
Oh, isn't that fun? Well, I think we need to respond with our own 35-year-old female candidate. And that brings us to Kristi Noem, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. The new book, Not My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland. Governor Noem, thanks so much for joining us. Are you ready to take on AOC in 24?
Well, now you guys are my favorites, literally, like in the entire country. You just literally made me 15 years younger. So, stay with you guys the rest of the day. So, you know, that whole interview was crazy. If you guys watched that at all, she talked about Congress, making sure that the Supreme Court stopped legislating. She had no understanding necessarily of what the role of each branch of government was. It's just... to have leaders today whose votes have such consequence on our day-to-day lives, not even take the time to understand the gift that the founders gave us in this great country is extremely discouraging, I think, for the average citizen. What I would say is, luckily, we've got more people paying attention than we ever have before. I think COVID woke up a lot of people that live in the United States of America and said, boy, we got to start getting involved or we're going to lose this country. And while the rest of the world is depressed at what we see, I think today we should take a little bit of hope out of that we've got a lot of people engaged that really do care about our way of life.
Before we get into some of the policy issues too, I mean, your book, Not My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland, so it talks about your childhood on a farm, and I just was wondering, because, you know, I can't help but think about you now in context of Yellowstone. And I just wonder how close the Beth Dutton character is to who you actually are.
Oh, when I grow up, I want to be Beth. I mean, honestly. But I do think that people have sent me, I bet I've gotten 50 T-shirts in the mail.
Oh my gosh.
From people across the country that have said, don't make me go Beth Dutton on you. So so it's either Beth or the governor on there that people tend to write me a note about. But I don't know. But it's amazing to me that show has really made people in this country curious about the American West. And that gives us in South Dakota an opportunity to kind of tell our story. We're not exactly like that show for sure. There's a lot more killing and stuff going on that show than I see in South Dakota, but there are some good people who still care about their way of life.
Well, you talk about involvement of people just kind of waking up. I grew up in South Dakota, great state. I've got family still there, and I understand that you just had kind of a huge GOP convention last weekend, largest turnout ever. And so what do you attribute that to?
Well, I'm pretty proud that you're from South Dakota. That makes me so happy. I love that. So
I'm headed back there too for the 4th of July, by the way. We'll be right there on the river.
Oh my goodness, that sounds fantastic. Good deal. Well, you know, our GOP convention was last weekend. We did have record turnout, and we were very much engaged in, you know, uniting the party, making sure that we were focused on really what is at stake in this next election cycle. South Dakota has a lot of Republican elected officials right now, but that hasn't always been the truth. You know, when I ran for Congress just in 2010, I ran against a Democrat. We still had a U.S. Senator that was a Democrat.
I remember the Tom Daschle years, honestly.
Yeah,
that's where
absolutely.
I grew up. So, yeah.
I went to Northwestern with his son.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Goodness sakes. Well, yeah. So people tend to think South Dakota is very, very Republican, and it is right now. But we're also, I would say, have a tendency to be much more populist. We vote for who we like. In fact, when I ran for governor the first time around, I only beat my opponent by 3 points, and he was a Bernie Sanders guy. So, you know, it's important that we continue to keep people informed and working and out there engaged with the public, and that's what Republican Party conventions do.
And talk about energy policy a little bit, because I know this is central to your policy agenda as governor and just as an American. Speak to that a little bit in the context of what Americans are grappling with at present.
Well, it's shocking to me still every time I, you know, am filling my truck up with fuel, and, you know, we're looking at diesel prices with our tractors, and you talk to families that are on very tight budgets, and they're trying to deal with having to drive their kids to events and baseball games in the summer and driving 30 miles the opposite direction to go to work. You know, in South Dakota, it's not an option not to drive. You just have to every day to take care of your families. So these types of energy policies cripple states like ours, because there just isn't a way of life where we don't need energy. And we grow the nation's food, the world's food, too. So it's pretty important that we keep the trucks running on time. You know, Biden has done this on purpose. There's no way somebody is this inept, and no way that somebody can be in politics and government this long and not understand what they're doing by shutting down the Keystone Pipeline, making us more dependent on Venezuela, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and the Middle East for our fuel. It is making us much more vulnerable to control by those who hate us. And this is why it's just so important that we not only talk about the day-to-day struggles of dealing with a tightened budget because of this energy policy, but we recognize the big picture, too, that the Democrat Party right now is trying to remake this country and remake this republic and give the government more and more power over our lives. And that's why it's important we show up. We talk to our neighbors. We got a lot of people in this country that have been offended by somebody in their life and quit talking to them. I'm going to tell them to do the exact opposite. More now than ever, we have got to come together and start recognizing that unity is how we push back on a federal government that's become overbearing and taking away our future.
Well, South Dakota provides a great contrast to the state that I'm presently living in, Illinois. And, you know, I've been an Illinois resident for 30 years here. So, I mean, but honestly, let's just talk to the abortion issue. So you're calling special session, it appears, in order to review the trigger law that will go into effect in the wake of the Roe v. Wade decision being overturned. in our state, our governor's calling a special session to also review abortion laws when we have the most extreme laws in the country. So you've done some really good stuff, and I've heard about that you also got a website, apparently, that you launched to help women in crisis.
We do. South Dakota in 2005 passed a law that said if Roe v. Wade was ever overturned, that abortion would immediately become illegal at that point, and it would only be allowed to save the life of a mother. So when this decision came down last week, you know, that became the law of the land. And it's recognizing that every life is precious. What's interesting to me is we've had ballot measures since then to completely ban abortion. Those have not been successful at the state level for one reason or another. This will continue to be a topic of debate in our state, but I think what the Supreme Court did is really what should have happened years and years ago. They fixed a wrong decision from almost 50 years ago to return this decision-making power back to the states, back to elected officials and the people closer to home. So I'm grateful for the decision. I'm pro-life, obviously. I think that the science and technology we've had and seen develop over the last 10 to 15 years tells us so much more about what's going on in the womb and the pain babies feel, and then also just the medical side of this, how doctors define these babies in the womb as patients and give them patients' rights. How do we turn around then and say that they're not a real human being? And how do we embrace some integrity on this issue, recognizing that there's lots of dynamics that just weren't debated 15 to 20 years ago? So I don't want the legacy of South Dakota to be one of come to our state to get an abortion. What I heard the New York governor do this week by saying she wanted to be known as the state where you could come to kill your baby. Boy, I don't want that to be South Dakota's story at all. I'm proud that South Dakota has stood for freedom and that we have people that take care of each other. And we have a website we've launched that really is going to help us do a better job taking care of mothers and walking alongside them in these situations. Many of them, it is a crisis. It's an unplanned pregnancy. They don't know how they're going to get health care, financially take care of themselves, be parents, connect with adoptive families. South Dakota is going to help them in new ways that supports them in these decisions as well.
She is Kristi Noem. She's the governor of South Dakota, as you know. She's also the author of the new book, Not My First Rodeo, Lessons from the Heartland. Governor Noem, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Good luck with the book.
Oh, thank you. Hope you enjoy the book, and you guys have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too. And Governor Noem joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is Jeannie Ives, former state legislator, principal at Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, I can't believe this got by the Wall Street Journal editors, editorial page editors. This op-ed from our friend Casey Mulligan, University of Chicago, and David Henderson from Hoover Institution. It's got a typo right in the headline. It says Biden the headline is Biden is practically engineering a recession. Obviously, they meant to say Putin. I don't know how that got past. Casey Mulligan is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago's Ken Griffin Department of Economics. Ken Griffin. He also served as the chief economist of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in 2018, 2019 under Trump. He's the author of the book You're Hired, Untold Successes and Failures of a Populist President. Casey, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Jeannie.
Hey, hello. Before we get to your op-ed, is the economics department at the University of Chicago also moving to Miami?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Chicago has talked about moving over the decades, but it never happened. It's tough to move all those Gothic buildings.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Well, I just want the degree to still mean something, as my son just graduated from Booth.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Oh,
so,
there you go.
Keep up the good work.
Oh. Oh, well, maybe you can get a job in the Biden administration.
Well, he's headed to Texas. Oil and gas.
Yeah, right. Better. So what's with this typo in your op-ed, Casey? You said Biden, you meant to say Putin, is practically engineering a recession, right?
Well, a team of us had looked at Biden's economic agenda back in 2020 when we didn't know who the president would be. We just looked at what he said and what he had turned out. and he had planned some pretty heavy tax hikes, especially on business, and some a lot of regulation. And we thought, well, now's a good time to look back. Which of those has he done? And based on the effects, the size of the effects we thought would happen, what effects should we see from what he's done? And what we found is his regulation's pretty much according to plan because he doesn't really need Congress for that. There have been a few departments he'd done less than we thought and others he did more. But it's very heavily regulating the economy. And then on the tax side, you know, the Build Back Better hasn't made it through yet, but inflation has been a hidden tax that requires no Congress. And so he's got about half of his increase on business taxation and about all the increase in regulation. So we figure that that's reducing GDP growth by a percent or more per year. And it only takes a little bit in addition to that, and there you have a recession.
Well, right, and it's interesting because we're awaiting the Supreme Court decision in the West Virginia versus EPA case about, essentially these regulatory agencies and their ability to legislate where Congress doesn't. But when you talk about he's regulated some industries more heavily than others, what in terms of the regulations he has promulgated have been most negatively impactful, do you think?
Well, in the Department of Labor, he wanted to really crack down on micromanage payrolls and things like that, and he wasn't able to pull that off. The Manchin kind of stopped his appointee there. But then he did the mask mandates, a lot of it through the Department of Labor. I mean, some of it got blocked, but it was extremely disruptive. It's been a factor, for example, in the airline staffing and flight delays. And, you know, that's not good for airlines, but it's not good for any of us that use airlines to do business or pleasure, for that matter. In the environmental area, he's been aggressive. In banking, he's been very aggressive, in fact, with kind of an new environmental mission for the banking regulators. And these hurt businesses up and down. And I guess energy would be particularly affected by the regulations and the taxes. I mean, energy is a very capital-intensive industry, so when the business taxes go up, that really raises their costs, and they got to pass that on to the marketplace.
Well, so explain this to me, because the other side wants to say that there's plenty of Americans that have a lot of pent-up demand and a lot of money to actually fulfill that demand, and so this inflation issue is just not a problem for them, and the spending is going to continue. And so I don't know. I don't see that. Well, but
we don't eat money. We eat things that farmers make, and we don't drive money. We drive things that auto manufacturers make, and you go up and down the line. You need the supply if we want to have the goods and services, and that's what the regulation and taxes are heavily disrupting. So you don't have supply, and you just have money sloshing around. You get inflation.
What is your sense of the substantive recovery from the pandemic? I saw some data from our friend James Perry over at Arbor Research this week. If you adjust retail sales, post-pandemic retail sales for inflation, retail sales are actually down 6%. Which is a different story than it's generally being told. And it also provides some insight into what is or isn't happening with respect to the post-pandemic rebound that's much advertised.
Yeah, the retail sales can be confusing because it's standard report. What's nice about it is it comes out quickly, but the retailers measure their sales in dollars. They're not releasing the quantities of what's moving out the door. And so that takes some adjustments later, and he's right that once you have time to adjust, you realize the retailers are moving out fewer goods and services. Maybe there's more dollars coming in, but of course those dollars are worth less, which is the point. We really had two phases of the recovery. Under Trump, we had some massive growth, and then some brisk growth at the end of 2020, and then we got another boost when the unemployment benefits finally, bonuses, unemployment benefits go on, but the bonuses ended last summer. And we got some growth, especially in the blue states, on the second half of last year. But 2022 has been almost nothing.
Well, we contracted in Q1, and so the question becomes, too, you know, whatever term you want to use, you talk about Biden practically engineering a recession. That seems past tense that it's been, at this point, that it's been engineered. We're in recession, or at least a lot of people feel like they are.
Yeah, you could be right. There's a few different definitions. Some people define it according to how many people are employed. Others define it according to GDP. And then, like you said, the GDP, you had a negative in Q1. I think if you have another negative in Q2, you have to call that a recession. And in a way, that's the worst kind of recession. We're working more, but earning less.
Losing ground, right.
Yep.
Yes.
And John Cochran, who's an economist over at the Hoover Institution as well, talks about, you know, we're so focused on the Fed and, you know, every pronouncement that comes from Jay Powell and his board of mystics. He writes in the journal, does Cochran, monetary policy can't alone cure sustained inflation. The government also has to fix the underlying fiscal problem. And he goes on to say, we need to grow to raise long-run taxable income. And he said, raising taxes alone, which is what's been proposed by Biden, is like climbing a sand dune as each rise hurts income growth. The U.S. also needs spending reform, especially on entitlements, and it needs to break the cycle that each crisis will be met by a river of printed or borrowed money, bailouts for big financial firms, and stimulus checks for voters. We need to sort of break the cycle of how we address economic crises, even ones that we've engendered like we did in response to COVID.
I mean, he's right about that. The spending has to add up to the taxes, recognizing, as he does, that one of the taxes that doesn't need Congress is the inflation tax. And so if you're spending a lot and not taxing much on the traditional taxes, then you're just begging for inflation to come in and fill that gap.
He is Professor Casey Mulligan, Professor of Econ at University of Chicago, former chief economist of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in 18 and 19. The book, You're Hired, Untold Successes and Failures of a Populist President. Casey Mulligan, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Have a good day.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Brings me back to my childhood, but Sesame Street has undergone a bit of a conversion since I was a kid. Let me give you an example of what I mean, since we were talking a bit earlier, both with Casey Mulligan and Keith Peacow, different aspects of the pandemic, the response, the impact. We still have, government-financed PBS using puppets as propagandists. Listen to Elmo being tickled by the jab.
Now Daddy's got super-duper hero bandages just like Elmo.
You were a hero today, getting your COVID vaccine, Elmo.
There was a little pinch, but Elmo was really glad to have Daddy there with him.
I had questions about Elmo getting the COVID vaccine. I talked to our pediatrician and learned that the vaccine is the best way to keep him and everyone else healthy.
It's okay to have questions about COVID vaccines for your kids. Get the latest facts by speaking to your pediatrician or healthcare provider.
What do you think of Elmo on Sesame Street? They're pushing vaccinations, obviously, for kids under five.
Well, I think I want to know who the donors are to the organization Sesame Street. I'm Ben.
We are.
Well, probably some big pharmaceutical companies, too.
Well, this right. Exactly. But Pfizer sponsors the news, right?
Exactly.
Big Bird brought to you by Sesame Street. Snuffleupagus brought to you by Merck, right? Et cetera, et cetera. No, I mean, but this is the sort of the perniciousness of it all. And of course, they would say, well, look, what was the message? Oh, we just said, you know, if you have questions, it's okay. Consult your pediatrician. Right. No, the message was Elmo's a hero because he got a jab, and that's exactly what you should do if you want your kid to be safe and be a hero. And it's virtue signaling both. It's propagandizing to the kid, and it's propagandizing to the adult about being a virtue signaler.
Yeah, I don't understand it. Kids were not necessarily affected by COVID, you know, and unfortunately, though, you know, here's a good news, Dan. Many, 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 many parents are saying, no, we're not doing it.
Yeah.
So
perpetual COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Perpetual Pfizer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy this morning is former state legislator, gubernatorial candidate, Jeannie Ives, now the principal at Breakthrough Ideas. And Jeannie, I like this piece by Brian Gitt at realclearenergy.org. Chasing Utopian Energy, How I Wasted 20 Years of My Life. Not very conservationist of him. It sort of reads like Dr. Strangelove, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. But this is no parody. It's an apology. Not Schellenberger quality apology, but not bad.
Take what you can get from these people. It's about time.
Says he's an energy entrepreneur. He'll just give you a little bit of what he says he used to believe, which he now knows is untrue. I used to think solar and wind power are the best ways to reduce CO2 emissions, but the biggest reduction in CO2 emissions during the past 15 years, over 60%, has come from switching from coal to natural gas. Yeah. I used to think the world was transitioning to solar, wind, and batteries. This, too, was false. Trillions of dollars were spent on wind and solar projects over the last 20 years, yet the world's dependence on fossil fuels declined only 3 percentage points from 87% to 84%. I used to believe nuclear energy was dangerous and nuclear waste was a big problem. In fact, nuclear is the safest and most reliable way to generate low-emission electricity, and it provides the best chance of reducing CO2 emissions. It was clear now I was chasing utopian energy. I was using green energy myths as moral camouflage, and I was able to believe those myths as long as I remained ignorant about the real costs and benefits of different energy sources. I mean, it's refreshing.
Do you think he could come and give his confessional in front of the Illinois General Assembly?
Yeah.
That'd be great, because these guys went all in September for Illinois' version of the Green New Deal. Oh, you know, this makes sense. We're talking about food shortages. And what do we do here in Illinois? Oh, we grow, you know, second most productive corn production here, soybeans. We export a lot of this. We feed the world from Illinois. And yet we're going to import Chinese solar panels and put them on our productive farmland, because that's what the Democrats in this state want to do. It's insanity. Insanity. You have rolling blackouts already predicted by MISO. Oh, for you up here in the northeast section that are, you know, get your nuclear power that provides your electrical output. Great. I mean, J.B. Pritzker, you can sit in any one of your homes, Wisconsin, Florida, your Chicago mansion. You're going to be fine. The lights are going to stay on for you.
Just not
the
on the
rest
toilets.
Of the state. Yeah. Yeah, right. The rest of the state, no. They're predicting rolling blackouts.
Brownouts and blackouts.
And they had a committee hearing for it, a four-hour committee hearing that I listened to just a few weeks ago. And what was revealed there? That even the Illinois Commerce Commission warned them over a year ago, saying if you pass CEJA, the Clean Energy Jobs Act, because everything has like this slick title that means nothing, means the opposite, actually. It's not clean energy. Even though you pass when you pass that, ICC warned, we don't know where we're going to get our energy from.
Yeah.
Great. Good. Great.
Something else from this just perspective. And again, you know, you need to give people room to come over to your side. So we're giving Brian Gitt room to come over to the side of just sensible policy based in rational thinking. Something else he wrote: I learned how to see things not just the way environmentalists do, but also the way utilities, governments, builders, engineers, lenders, and manufacturers see them. You know, and also, too, how about learning to see them from how consumers see them? You know, Bastiat was right that if you want to act in furtherance of humanity, look at these all decisions through the eyes of the consumer. And somebody who does that brilliantly on energy policy consistently and has for a long time, which is why we enjoy talking to him, because his arguments are evidence rich, is Bjorn Lomborg, who's the president of the the Copenhagen Consensus think tank. He's also the author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan, it's great to be back.
Well, this mea culpa from Brian Gitt over at Real Clear Energy must be music to your ears.
I saw it, and I think he's basically telling you what a lot of people in the energy space knows, namely that, sure, there are lots of great sort of intentions wanting to try to green the world, but the reality is right now that we're spending an enormous amount of resource money, mostly, and delivering very little CO2 reduction. And so we've got to ask ourselves, are we doing the right thing? And I think there's a lot of reasons why, no, we're actually not. In many ways, we're trying to make the world worse by, you know, in all these good intentions, denying especially poor people in the world access to energy, which is what lifted us out of poverty and which will lift them out of poverty too.
Something you write about in the New York Post, this piece in the New York Post, which is important too. It's, you know, so how are we at this place? And now you've got politicians like Biden, you know, pounding the table saying, refine more oil. Well, since 2015, you write, since the 2015 Paris Agreement was inked, the world's 1,200 biggest energy corporations have slashed capital investment in oil and gas by more than two-thirds. So, as you write, huge prices are the inevitable result of forcing more energy out of an increasingly starved system.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've had politicians that for 30 years plus have tried to say, let's make fossil fuels as expensive as possible so that people will switch to green energy. Well, surprise, now they got their wish. And of course, what you're seeing is nobody, no politician want to take a victory lap and say, yay, we finally made fossil fuel incredibly expensive, because no voters want that. The trick here is not to make something that undergrids most of our prosperity so expensive you can't afford it. The trick, of course, is eventually to make green energy so cheap that everybody will want it. But that's a very different approach. It's really realizing that we have never solved problems in our human history by making things unaffordable, by telling people, no, you can't do this. We've done so through innovation. If you think back to the 1950s in Los Angeles, it was a terribly polluted place, mostly because of a lot of cars. The solution to that problem was not to tell everyone in Los Angeles, I'm sorry, you've got to walk now. That would obviously have never flown. What did solve much of the problem was the catalytic converter. You pay a price. Yes, it's not free. You put on this a little gizmo, and basically your car drives more and emit perhaps 99% less pollution. That's how you solve problems. The same way we need for climate. We're not going to solve this by making fossil fuels so expensive nobody can afford it. We need to make green energy so cheap everyone will want it.
Are we at a tipping point? That's what I'm hoping for, because there's no other topic, I think, policy-wise that makes less sense than this idea of green energy in this in Illinois, that we're going to just simply ban fossil fuels after 2050. Mm. Like, they're just gone. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. These politicians aren't listening. But who do we blame for this? Is it the schools? Is it the universities? Is it businesses who aren't actually, you know, they're trying to play both sides of the aisle and instead of just putting out the truth? I mean, because I'm tired of it.
Really, yes, and I think a lot of people are tired of it. I think you're right that there is a tipping point in the sense that people are really, really sick and tired of this when it hurts their wallet as much as it does right now. So, you know, you can play along and say, sure, we should go green when you're basically being told, oh, it won't cost you anything. And maybe it'll cost you a little bit. You know, most people are nice people and willing to spend a little bit. But once it becomes this incredibly costly thing, and it is now, people are no longer willing to play along. And so I think we're realizing now that you can't actually make these arguments. I find it so astonishing how the G7 and, you know, all the rich countries in the world is telling essentially the poorer countries of the world, I'm sorry, you can't use fossil fuels. You have to switch to solar and wind, while We have, you know, Biden flying to Saudi Arabia and begging for more oil, while we have lots of European countries scouring Africa for more coal. There's something so ironic about this that it's hard to not realize and see. And that makes people realize, yeah, maybe this is not the right way to go. Look, there's a real problem with global warming. So I think we need to say, yes, it is a problem, but the way we're tackling it is incredibly expensive, doesn't help very much, and is in many ways really hurtful, especially to the world's poor. Let's find a better way.
Well, right. And again, for all of the trillions that have been spent, solar and wind, and this is, again, your piece in the New York Post, deliver 1.8% of global energy supply. So we want to reduce our energy supply to, you know, by 98%, then this is the way to go. It's going to be a very different world we're all living in, and then much darker one and colder.
And it's just not going to happen. This is what's so amazing, right? I mean, we're talking about, people are saying, well, we'll switch off all our fossil fuel use in 2050. No, we won't. I mean, first of all, if you look at the current scenarios, so all of the policies that countries have promised so far, the International Energy Agency estimate we'll only get in the rich world about a third of our energy from renewables by 2050. We're making these grand claims, but of course we're not actually willing to pay up for it. McKinsey a couple of months ago showed that going net zero would mean that we would have to spend about 7.5% of global GDP every year to achieve this. Remember, this is, you know, a lot in the US or in Europe, but it's an enormous amount in most other countries that tax a lot less. We're talking about spending about half the global tax intake on climate policy. Of course you're not going to get away with that. Of course voters are not going to let you do that. And that's why we need to stop this idea of saying, oh, we're going to achieve all our goals. No, we're not. We're right now making silly goals that we know are not going to stand up. What we need is getting smarter, more simple goals, namely focus on innovation, just like we did with the catalytic converters in Los Angeles. Focus on the stuff that actually works. And then, of course, also recognize that we need lots and lots of energy. That's the way that we've delivered growth in the past and the way we're going to deliver it in the future.
And now it's a national security issue.
Yes, it is. But for a reason I think most people didn't think of, it's a national security issue because it costs so much that you're actually going to bankrupt a lot of people. And so clearly, people don't want you to screw up their energy supply and deliver enormous energy bills for them. What they want is good, reliable energy. Oh, and they would like it to be green. Green is not bad, but green is just not worth spending an enormous fortune on to achieve almost nothing.
He is Bjorn Lomborg, president of the Copenhagen Consensus Center and author of False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Bjorn Lomborg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Great to talk to you guys.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and former state legislator Jeannie Ives now at Breakthrough Ideas, sitting in for Amy J this morning. Take a couple calls and reaction to our conversation with Bjorn Lomborg on energy policy. Bill Glen Ellen, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, see, I think Mr. Lomborg and a lot of other people don't understand what's going on. The people who are pushing the green energy are the ones who think that, one, the world is overpopulated,
yeah,
and two, that humans are destroying the planet. So if they can create unreliable energy, that would mean we have to have fewer people. If they can hurt the food supply by turning up the farmland to put in the solar panels, that, again, means fewer people. And they target the poor countries because they don't have the power to vote. So they can do whatever they want to them in the goal of reducing population size. And so when you look at it from that point of view, it all makes sense about the dumb things they're doing with energy, because they're achieving the goals that they actually want.
Thanks for the call, Bill. I mean, it's a good point about the ZPGers, the population bombers. the Pollard-elect types. Yes, I mean, there are people that believe the planet is overpopulated, which is why they're for population control, meaning abortion, meaning euthanasia, meaning, you know, culling the herds, starvation, poverty. Yeah, it's a pretty dystopian, sick stuff. But you're right. There are people who believe that, and they're in places of some repute in policy circles, like the academy, like media.
If you're an atheist, like Sean Caston, that's what you believe too.
Yeah, like members of Congress. Yep. There you go, Russ in Frankfurt.
Yes, good show. First time caller. I'm really concerned about the way they say it's Biden's problem and he created this. And I'm thinking it's my problem because I'm the one that's going to have to live through this. This guy may not make it for another couple of years. We just got to do something. I've got signs in my front yard that say, freedom, you were born free. Don't give that up for lies. And tyranny is the problem. You are the solution. And I don't know if anybody sees it. I changed anybody's mind or made anybody think about it. But unless we do something, he's going to keep rolling along. And whether he's in charge or somebody else is pulling the strings, it doesn't make any difference. One of these days, it'll be too late. I mean, I've been hearing it's too late for a long time. Well, maybe it's coming down to when it really will be too late.
Thanks for the call, Russ. Appreciate it. John, Bridgeport.
How's it going, guys?
Good.
Now, listen, if you ever want to look at the way these freaking green people operate, look at the recycling business here in Chicago. And even though it gives people a peace of mind, you're not doing the damn thing, okay? Number two, the earth is not fragile, people. All you Californians out there, the earth is not fragile. And the policies of government's what screwed up your state. Now, Dan, I don't know when's the next time I'm going to be able to talk to you, but I really need you to sound the alarm when it comes to these voting systems and the way they're ran. Because right now, the pulse of America is the Democrats are going to get slaughtered. But if we don't have our eye on these damn election machines, we're in trouble. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for the call, John.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
This is a interesting piece from Matt Rosenberg over at wirepoints.com. Our friend Ted Dabrowski, you know, his outfit over there, along with Mark Lennon and others. Looking at 911 dispatch calls to the Chicago police in 2021, they FOIA'd the information. Out of 788,000 high priority 911 calls dispatched in 2021, more than 406,000 or 52% high-priority emergency service calls from residents to Chicago police, no police available to respond. 52% of 788,000 high-priority. What does high-priority mean? We're talking about priority one or priority two level calls. Priority one level incident, and this is the definition from dispatch, from police, represent an imminent threat to life, bodily injury, or major property damage loss. Priority two calls, an incident where, quote, timely police action has the potential to affect the outcome of an incident. 52% of those calls, no police available to respond. 406,000 incidents.
So why are you paying property taxes in Chicago?
Wow. Why are you living in Chicago?
Yeah.
If you don't have to.
Absolutely.
Wow. And you wonder why people don't feel safe, and you wonder why there is such an issue made of being down more than 2,000 police officers under Mayor Triple Threat. 406,000, I mean, I can't say it enough, 406,000 calls, priority one or two level incidents, no police available to respond. For more on this and other issues, it's not exactly her purview, but it's part of the conversation, police and public safety for candidates at every level, including Catalina Lauf, who won the Republican congressional primary in Illinois 11 to face the dizzying personality, Mr. I Break for Particle Accelerators, Bill Foster. Catalina Lauf, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So talk a little bit about your perspective on police, on public safety. And, you know, we've seen some efforts to enlist federal help for places like Chicago. And by the way, I mean, some of the suburban areas, including areas you're running to represent, have some crime issues, too. Not on the order of Chicago, but they do have some.
Aurora certainly does.
And so, I mean, as a member of Congress, what your perspective is on sort of federal support for state and local law enforcement.
Yes, I'm so happy you brought this up. You know, we are living in a time where culture is running politics. You're seeing up to 200% retirement for law enforcement officers in the city of Chicago, and that's actually also impacting the exurbs. Also in the police academy, their application rates are at the lowest they have ever been. I mean, we're not talking just hundreds of, we're talking thousands of people who are not joining our law enforcement. Why? Because they have been vilified. They're not able to do their jobs. And they have been demonized by the far left progressive extremists and the media. And that's where the data is showing that it's impacting our law enforcement. And ultimately, you're right, Jeannie. Aurora has a lot of crime. Look at what happened in Naperville and Aurora during the riots, after the riots last year, where not a single person, especially the Democrats, condemned that violence, other than a few people on the Republican. But this shouldn't even be Republican or Democrat anymore. Violence is violence, and it needs to be a principled stance. And people, elected officials, need to make sure that they're providing the resources, and even if it comes from the federal level, but it shouldn't all the time. This should be local as possible, but we need to take a stand on this to make our communities safer.
Well, just to add a little context here, the Naperville mayor, Chirico, bowed to BLM Marxist, took a knee, and had his police officers take a knee. And then, of course, you have Richard Irvin, mayor of Aurora, you know, praising BLM. So, I mean, when elected officials fall in with the people that are doing the rioting, you got a problem there, too.
It's absolutely sick. And it's sad also, you know, you look at Kim Fox and Lori Lightfoot. We know Chicago is, we know what to expect from Chicago. But when it comes into our quaint suburbs, our exurbs, where parents and people are very concerned with the safety and security of their community, not to mention in Aurora, there's also a high Hispanic community. And we all want safer and secure communities, and we want to make sure that law and order is, it's going to be one of the top issues this election season, because what's been going on, as I said, the culture is running politics nowadays. And to Jeannie's point, when you have these elected officials bowing down to the culture wars, you're going to see an impact in how it directly affects us, as we've seen over the last few years.
So pulling back from this issue and into the broader matchup between you and Bill Foster, you know, what's essentially is the pitch to voters to say it's time to retire Bill Foster and turn the page and usher in a new generation and a new attitude?
It's so clear after the primary wins this last Tuesday that Illinoisans are ready for common sense people. You know, we're living during a time where the radicals are taking over the entire country. They've certainly already taken over Congress, and it's now impacting the state at all levels. And it's time to just bring back common sense. Look, most people, when I went to every single part of the district during the campaign, and I would walk into Walgreens, CVS, grocery stores, there is still a baby formula shortage. Our supply chains are still interrupted. Our small businesses are still interrupted. The labor force is still not growing as much as it should be. And Illinoisans are impacted the most. because of already our regressive economic policies that are thanks to J.B. Pritzker and the leftist here. And so all we want are people who are going to bring back pro-growth economic policies. They're not sitting there protesting with lobbying groups like Bill Foster is doing. Instead of actually working for his constituents, his office was closed for the last 2 years. And you had people who had real issues looking for their members of Congress, and they were nowhere to be found, Bill Foster included. So at this point, it's about bringing a new face, new perspective, making sure that these, you know, progressive elitists like Bill don't have the honor of being a member of Congress and representing people when you're not representing all the voices. He's representing the radical far left extremists of his party, and because it helps them fundraise and it's what they truly believe. And it's time we bring back a voice for all the people and bring back common sense.
So let's do a little Leesburg grid here. You know, the old, what do you say about you? What do you say about your opponent? What does your opponent say about you? What does your opponent say about him? So what is Bill Foster going to say about you, and how are you going to respond?
They've already started with the attacks on the Republican extremism and, you know, what they've just been calling the entire Republican Party for the last 2 years. And frankly, you know, if this is the same party that was calling parents domestic terrorists because they wanted to fight for their own rights and their kids' rights against the unconstitutional mandates and against critical race theory and things like that, well, then, you know what? That's fine. They can call me whatever they want. But ultimately, we're a normal, ordinary American who left my life to come here to run. And, you know, I think the people will see just the stark difference between somebody who actually wants to represent them and who the actual extremists are. Look, they're pushing for, you know, late term abortions up to 9 months. I mean, that is extreme. And 75% of Americans actually disagree with that. But if that's what they're going to use all day and call us the extremists, then we're going to make sure that people see who's the actual extremist, which is them.
Since you brought it up, I want to get your reaction to something that Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra said the other day in an interview on CNN with Allison Camerota about what the federal government is going to consider doing under this administration and what you as a member of Congress would do or how you'd react. Take a listen to what he said.
How about the suggestion that's been floated by Senator Elizabeth Warren about carving out federal lands for abortion providers? Is that possible?
There are a number of conversations on any number of options that can be out there. We will certainly take a close look, as we made a commitment some time ago, months ago, as we were planning for whatever might come from the Supreme Court. We will take a look at every option to make sure a woman has access to the care that she needs.
Have you looked at that?
We're not prepared
one?
To say what that means. Yeah, all those things have been put on the table.
It's on the table, Catalina. I don't know exactly what that means. They're going to stand up and have federally run abortion mills on federal lands. I don't know exactly how that would work, but it's on the table, says Xavier Becerra.
No taxpayer should ever pay for abortion. And it's just so sick to me that at this point, this is what they're focusing on. When, again, you have families, especially here in Illinois, who are struggling to feed their families. You have gas prices are going to continue to go through the roof. You know, we are living during a time where, again, culture is running politics. And the fact that we have all this inflation, we have, again, families who are struggling with real kitchen table issues, and that's what their focus is, spending more of our taxpayer money on their agenda pushing initiative. We have to stop it. We have to stop it. This is getting ridiculous. And it's so sad to me, especially here in Illinois, where people feel like their voices are not heard. This state is Republican at heart, and we need to push back from the radical extremism that the progressives are trying to push today in our country, and certainly in Illinois.
Well, we'll see how those Naperville suburban moms respond and Geneva moms as well, you know, because they like to play the identity politics. And, you know, the Democrats, you know, they basically gerrymandered the 3rd Congressional District, which I am actually in. And I'm going to now be represented probably by that Delia Ramirez from Humboldt Park area and way out in Wheaton. That's who I'm going to be represented by, some far left progressive Hispanic woman. Right. And so what how are the Naperville moms going to respond when they look at, you know, I'll just say it, old, white, wealthy Bill Foster compared to you? Young, attractive woman with, you know, immigrant background. So what do you think they're going to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've been speaking with a lot of the moms down in the area. And, you know, ultimately, they are waking up. I will tell you, we get emails, we get requests all the time for meet and greets by those suburban moms, because over the last 2 years, they are waking up at just, again, the radicalism. They didn't want their kids masked. They didn't want to be forced into unconstitutional mandates. You know, we had a lot of moms who were nurses, who were working in the suburbs. And they are waking up because of just how they realize how far government will go. And we saw that during the COVID lockdowns. We're seeing it now. And ultimately, if we're able to, you know, speak with them in person and say, this is, you are not alone. They are now getting together in their groups. They have neighborhood groups that are, you know, the mom groups and things like that on Facebook. They are now coming together, and we actually have a lot of them now who want to run for school board. And so we're also helping out those efforts. So they're coming together now. They are waking up because they are ultimately fighting for their kids. You don't want to make a mama bear mad. And we've seen that. We've seen that over the last 2 years. And we're so thankful that they are going to be voting Republican this year. We know it.
And you were the victor in a crowded Republican primary field. You've talked to all of your competitors. Everybody's on board.
Yes, I have. And I just wanted to say, you know, it's very tough. It's not an easy choice to run for anything. And Jeannie, you know this as well. It's not an easy choice. It has become easier because of just the times that we're living in. You know, people want to step up, but it's very tough in this environment. And I commend everybody who wants to step into the arena and who wanted to be a voice. And we need people like Jerry Evans and Susan Hathaway and Mark Carroll. We need those people here in Illinois to provide the leadership in the state that for a long time has not had Republican leaders. And again, Jeannie, you know this, it takes all of us now to step up and be those people in our communities so that, again, we can we have the best message. Republican messaging always wins, but we need the right messengers. And so I, you know, I commend their efforts. They fought hard, and ultimately I look forward to working with them here in November to defeat Bill Foster, but all of the other candidates in this cycle, and also those who won the nominees, to be able to defeat the Democrats this cycle.
She is Catalina Loeff. She's the Republican nominee for Congress in Illinois 11 to face Bill Foster. It is in play. It's one of those suburban congressional races that's in play in Illinois this year. More information on her campaign and candidacy, CatalinaForCongress.com. CatalinaForCongress.com. Catalina Loeff, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
And she joined us on the turnkey.provincial line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.